take 100 herons and chop their heads off, eviscerate the herons, and then it went on to put spices like mace and nutmeg and cinnamon, and then to pickle them. And it was, do you know what it reminded me of? Like, almost like an escabeche.
There exists around the world something of a movable feast of high-end global chef gatherings. It started maybe with Madrid Fusion, and then Cook It Raw, Mad Symposium, and in recent years, Food on the Edge in Galway, Ireland, a four-day celebration of Irish products and global chef culture. I was invited to Food on the Edge last month to talk about Bourdain and his writing. That's a difficult thing to do even in good times, something like taking pictures of someone else's music. And I probably would not have gone if it weren't for the man you'll hear in this episode, the founder of Food on the Edge, J.P. McMahon. J.P. has a voluminous red beard and mischievous eyes, a Michelin star and a delightfully foul mouth. He's everything I want from an Irishman. We talked about Irish food culture, Bourdain's legacy, and then J.P. did something I did not expect. He used the verb to fuck something to mean to throw it, as in, it's fish, just fuck it all in a box. How could you not love Ireland? This is Nathan Thornburg, and you're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. JP, what are we drinking?
We're drinking Dingle Gin. Dingle Gin and some elderflower that we've preserved from the earlier on in the year.
And what is Dingle Gin?
Dingle Gin is gin that's brewed in Dingle. But it just sounds really good, yeah, Gin. But it's got some, I suppose part of the gin revolution that has happened in Ireland. I suppose the same happened all over the world. Everyone started to make gin. Could you call it a terroir gin? Is that too fancy?
Nothing's too fancy for...
It's got roan berries, juniper, fuchsia, bog myrtle, heather, chervil, hawthorn, and angelica and coriander, so...
Jesus.
Yeah, no.
That's like a whole prairie.
Yeah, fuck, it's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We smelling this now?
Yeah. It's subtle, you know.
I dig it. I mean, don't let me start shit here, but isn't gin like the booze of the oppressor?
Yeah, that's true. Like I don't know if the British didn't invent it, but I think it came from Holland. Possibly.
It's the Dutch, but you know, they came, it's the Protestant drink.
Yeah.
For starters.
Maybe that's why it's doing so well, you know, Catholicism is on the way out, so everyone in Ireland is becoming a Protestant. I've actually made a seaweed gin myself, from a base spirit, and it's nice.
We're going to mix some elderflower in case we need some more botanicals.
You don't have to, you know, I don't want to force it into you.
Have we met before?
No, like we got two beautiful glasses. And we've got some gin.
Came from an overnight flight from New York, just landed this morning. This is perfect gin time. So you're putting elderflower.
It's elderflower cordial. Yeah. Cordial. We might need to put a bit of sparkling water. Just because I don't want to fucking make it taste like piss. Elderflower has.
That would be really embarrassing. Yeah. This famous Irish chef made me a piss cocktail.
Cheers.
Here's to that.
I think there's not enough gin in it.
For 2 p.m?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
It's... All right.
We'll just put a drop in.
Yeah.
No. I think...
Just a dingle.
Yeah, just a touch of dingle.
All right, tell me where we are.
We're looking out the window over Galway Bay, and we're in the Galmont Hotel, and we're, I suppose, getting ready for Food on the Edge.
So, Food on the Edge is a annual conference. It's been going on for 5 years?
Four years.
4 years?
Yeah.
It's become like one of the kind of must-do stops in this very interesting subculture of like culinary wanderers.
Yeah, pretty much.
And you have like 500 or 600 people coming tomorrow.
Yeah.
A couple dozen speakers.
I think nearly 50 speakers.
50 speakers.
Mm.
Now I feel a lot less special.
And so I just thought it'd be a cool idea too. And it was kind of taken from the TED Talks. And I just like this idea of someone getting up for 15 minutes, giving what they give, and then someone else getting up, and it keeps the audience fresh, and it also you also get a lot of different diversity in the speakers. Then you don't just get, like, I suppose if you have 1 hour speakers, I mean it's hard to get more than 8 a day.
Yeah.
And so we have like 25. It's great, and it just produces so much content in terms of people thinking and talking and then interacting and over lunch and breaks and that. And so, yeah, it's quite dynamic.
You founded it, continue to run it.
Yeah, keep trying to fly the flag. I mean, for the majority of the 20th century, I don't think we had much of a food culture. Of course, there were pockets of greatness, like small greatness. But by and large, we were, I suppose, a country that produced food for export, you know. We exported oysters, we exported beef, we exported mussels, lobsters, crab. Like, we just sent everything away. And then,
and what were you guys eating?
Fucking stew and what the fuck else was I eating? I mean, nothing memorable anyway, you know.
It's just a long, bleak century of...
Yeah, like...
Eating the leftover bits that you didn't sell across the,
yeah, that you didn't, ocean. Yeah, that you didn't sell to someone else. And I suppose in the last 20 years or so... it has come together. And again, there was individuals probably throughout the 20th century. I mean, you've got Myrtle Allen, who passed away this year in her 90s. I mean, she was pretty much the godmother of Irish food. And she opened up in the 60s in Cork, and she started this farm-to-table movement, a bit like Alice Waters did. And she was doing it. But again, there was very small pockets. She was the beginning for me of what could happen, literally by just going out and seeing what was in the field beside you and then using that.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, you could look at, try and analyze the history of it, but like how it happened. I mean, you can't just put it down to one man and one restaurant, but like it's a whole cultural shift, you know. And it, of course, there's a certain organicness to make it happen, but also there's a lot of constructive things that you can do, and I'd like to see that happen in Ireland, you know.
I love how you're like, I'd like to see that happen. Meanwhile, JP's been pushing somewhat demonically over the last 4 years to just push this through. And, you know, every time I talk to somebody about you, it's just like, boy, he just won't let that fucker die. Like, he just keeps pushing it. It keeps growing and gets bigger and bigger. And it's,
yeah, like, I think anyone who's cooking has something to say, you know.
I mean, I've never eaten your cooking, but you've got a lot of Michelin stars over the years, and I assume you're pretty good at it. But you're also a writer and a communicator, and so I want to ask you about those things. So let's drop back. I have another sip of this. Drink this.
Yeah, it makes a lovely sound as well. Mm. I love the sound.
It's like sleigh bells. It's it's like Christmas in my mouth.
It's the dingles.
It's dingles. All the dingles.
For me, I'm so fascinated with stuff like seaweed and oysters and shellfish, which have been here thousands of years. Thinking about, like, why aren't they in the normal narrative of our everyday eating? Even to take an example, like last night in the restaurant, we had in Anir, our Michelin star restaurant, we had two customers, one who had never had mussels before and one who had never had oysters before.
I mean, that's very Danish. Like, they've got incredibly cold, clear blue waters, great Limfjord oysters, and a population that is just fucking dying to eat a pork chop.
Yeah, 100%. Well, you could say Ireland is similar. I mean, we pigs and beef, you know, and a sprinkling of lamb. You know, that's pretty much what we eat all the time. And we're known for bacon and potatoes, you know. I mean, throughout history. And actually, the irony is that the more potatoes we got, the more pigs we got, because we had loads of potatoes, so you could feed them to the pigs. And so we kept on making spuds, and then we made pigs and spuds. And
there you've got a national dish.
You have a national dish of bacon, cabbage, and mash. It's a tragedy where, when you think of stuff like sea urchins, you know, and it's really hard to get wild sea urchins now in Ireland, because we overfished them in the 70s and we sold them to everyone else. We just fucking sent them out.
Yeah.
And I remember watching a little documentary where this guy down in Cork had said he just remembers trucks coming to collect them in the 70s, and the locals were like, ah, yeah, fucking spiky things.
Right.
Get them out of here. Probably went to Japan, where they appreciate them, you know. I mean, I'm fascinated with Japan, and we were just talking about it. I haven't been yet, but how they turned the sea into gold, you know, and we just have not. Like, the way fish is treated, the way shellfish and seaweed, and we just, yeah. I hope we get there. At the moment, we're on the crest of a wave or something, you know. And maybe that's our tragedy, is that we, like, for all our kind of cries of independence, I mean, Ireland from 1600 was used as a grazing ground for cattle for the British Empire. And, you know, we fed the whole world with corned beef. It went to the States, it went to Caribbean, it went everywhere except the Irish people, who, we had a famine and they all starved. But it wasn't for want of food in the country.
What was food like in your household when you were growing up? Were you destined to be
not at all this people man? No, not at all. Actually, I just had that conversation last night with someone. They said, God, you must have been brought up on the best quality food. And I was like,
look at you,
the fuck are you talking about? I had like Rice Krispies and cornflakes in the morning. Fucking dodgy white sandwiches.
All right, so how did you have the first moment of culinary clarity?
In my early teens, I did home economics in school, and I enjoyed cooking. I had asthma, and there was only two choices. There was, like, do woodwork or home economics. And so I started cooking in home economics because I couldn't do woodwork. And, I started cooking. And then when I was 15, I took my first summer job. I took as a chef in the university kitchens. And, yeah, I suppose I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed not only transforming a raw product into a cooked product, but I also enjoyed the ability to cook for others. It's a little bit like alchemy, because we grew up in a family of six, and my parents, and so it was almost like there was an element of liberation being able to cook for people, even for my brothers and sisters. Probably the first culinary epiphany I had, I don't know what age I was, maybe I was 11 or 12. Was we were on holidays in Tipperary, and we went into a hotel to eat, and my mum was ordering burgers for everyone. And then for some reason, this was pre-cooking, I said, I'm going to have the spaghetti bolognese. And I remember my mum saying, you're not going to eat that. You won't like it. And I said, no, I'm going to have it. And so it came out with the smallest bit of parsley on top. And that's the first time I'd ever seen parsley. And I was like, wow, this little green thing on top. And tasted it. It was like, wow. I was like, I don't think I'd ever eaten a herb before, like a fresh herb.
Right.
And then I ate this spaghetti bolognese, and I mean, it could have been shit, I can't remember, but in my mind, it was the most magnificent thing I'd ever eaten, and it was different. And it was a way of making, of separating myself from everyone else, to say, no, I eat the spaghetti bolognese, you eat the burgers, you're the peasants, you know? Yeah. I know what I'm doing. And we still do that with food all the time. There is a cultural elitism, or a cultural, so many cultural divisions that we put up because of the ways and the things that we eat, you know?
Well, I mean, there's a tribe out there that I think goes across all class and race and any kind. It's just people who will try the shit and people who won't. You're already in some kind of rare club. And it's funny because, you know, I think Bourdain had talked about that experience being in France, you know, as a preteen and you know, deciding that he was going to eat an oyster.
Yeah, I remember.
And this, like, that this was, you know, both a way to torment his brother, would not eat an oyster, and to kind of, you know, define himself on an identity level. And he found it completely life-changing. And it sounds like that approach of just saying, like, I don't know who I am yet, but I am the person who ordered bolognese while all these other peons were eating burgers.
Yeah, 100%.
So somewhere in that, you started working in kitchens, but you also said, I mean, speaking of Bourdain, you've said that he, you know, and his writing was a big influence on you when you were young.
It was supposed to be. It was being able to combine those two things, cooking and writing. And I started writing when I was probably a similar time, 15 or 16. And like everyone starts, I think at that stage, right, you're writing poetry, you're writing some stories of that. And I really got into writing, but not in school. I mean, I was a fucking terrible fucking student in school. And I finished, did my exams, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So one of the things you could do when you couldn't do anything was you could go into a kitchen and start off as a KP, and then all of a sudden you're a chef, you know. And that's why I suppose Bourdain's story chimes so well with me. It was just that, well, what the fuck will I do? I like food. Okay, let's just... So I took a couple of jobs as a KP, and then I got a job as a chef. And then it was a great way to travel, you know, because then you could just go somewhere else and work in another Italian restaurant. But you kind of had that skill set. So went to Scotland. Oh, yeah, just I'll go into apply in Italian restaurants. Yeah. So I got a job in another Italian restaurant. At the same time, I knew I wanted to go back to college and study, and because I loved English and I loved literature and that. And so I went back as a mature student when I was 22 to study English and art history in Cork. And I thought I wasn't going to cook anymore. For the first 2 years, I didn't cook at all. I mean, I cooked at home, but I didn't cook professionally. And it wasn't until my third year I started running out of money again. And then I went back and started cooking again.
Yeah.
And I finished my degree, started a PhD in art history. I did that for 8 years. And in that period, I was cooking, and I just never... Got the hang of it. And in that period of time, we opened up 3 restaurants, had 2 children, and then I always had this PhD hanging over me that it was like just 2 separate lives that I was living. Yeah. And that's why I always loved Bourdain's writing, and also other writers like Nigel Slater and different people who loved food who wrote.
Yeah.
And combining the 2 things really well. And for a long time, I wasn't able to combine them because I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write fiction and plays, and I wanted to be a real writer. And I still feel, in spite of having written a cookbook and I write a column in the national newspaper every week, I still feel I'm not a writer yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I haven't written that piece of fiction, or I haven't written that. I know, and when you talk to journalists like this, I think I got a fucking punch in the face with some journalist. He was like, fuck you, and you're taking up my space in that fucking newspaper.
How about this?
With your fucking...
If you're not a writer, why don't you get the fuck off
the
page?
That's what he was saying, like, chef, do you, people like you are stealing my fucking job. And I was like...
That's very Brexit talk from the journalist there. I'll just get ahead of your argument there, like, one of the things that's been a revelation to me, having come from hard news and foreign correspondence and then shacking up with Matt, who cares about food above all things, and running into Tony, who was kind of in between, it's just that realization, which actually didn't take me very long at all, that like food is a very perfectly legitimate and in some ways just like incredibly fortuitous manner to be a writer. Like,
yes,
it's a thing.
I completely agree with you. And it's just, I still... get my doubts, but I do know. I mean, I'm working on another fucking cookbook now, and I do enjoy like crafting things with words, and I do enjoy explaining things and creating a narrative around like a fucking gin or something, like, oh, why is this here and now? So I'm still somewhere in between, you know. Yeah. I always say I'm just a confused chef, you know. I mean, I went back, when I didn't finish the PhD, I went and did an MA in English 2 years ago. And then I finished that, and then I started another PhD in drama.
Right, so that's a little fucked up.
Yeah,
like, you should probably just think about raising a family and running
a
bunch of successful...
They're downstairs at the moment.
Your daughters are at the bar. I
gave them my card and said, just buy what you need to buy. They're only 6 and 9, so they won't buy any alcoholic drinks.
Yeah.
And said, look, just get the ice cream, whatever you need, and I'll be back down in a while.
Why? That does bring up a good question of, why are you talking to me? Today, your beard should be on fire. You should be running around in total panic, and instead we're having this delightfully floral elderflower gin drink.
Someone asked me once, so like, what advice could you offer? And I once said, like, just talk to everyone, talk to people.
Yeah.
And they were saying, oh, like, in terms of cooking, I was like, talk to everyone. That is fucking cooking advice.
Because you want to know how to chiffonade? Talk to people.
Talk to people, because then you travel, you fucking talk, and you see that, and you see that in Matt's books. I mean, I think that's what I really love about them. It's that you see that traveling, talking, learning, cooking.
Yeah.
It's just a fucking... You get embedded in a culture. People always say to me, oh, do you not feel bad you didn't finish the PhD in that? But, I mean, I might have written 500,000 words.
Right, fuck those guys.
Yeah. But it didn't... I don't think I would have written a cookbook if I hadn't have failed doing the PhD, because it taught me how to write.
Yeah.
You know, and it taught me how to think and to structure things, and
yeah.
I think I took all the best bits and wove it into the story that our Cava cookbook tells. It's like, why cook Spanish food in Ireland? I mean, what are the reasons to do it? I mean, of course, one is personal, but there's also historical reasons, and there's also cultural reasons, and I just wanted to explore them.
Well, let's do the Cliff's Note version of that, because I am sort of fascinated that, you know, obviously Matt lives in Spain. We have a strong connection to Spain. That's one of the things that always stood out about you was, like, here's a man who started in restaurant touring in Spanish cuisine in Galway.
I loved Spain. We went to Barcelona quite a bit when we were in college. I had friends living there. My wife's brother lived there. And I think the two things that stick out to me was the way, and this is also ties in with the Italian, the way that food was embedded in culture, you know, that when you went out for drinks, you had food too. And when you shared food, and then when later on in the night, 12 or 1 or 2, there was still food. Yeah. And that didn't exist in Ireland. You went to the pub, you didn't eat, you just drank. And I just really loved that that way of eating, that kind of communal way of eating, and the variety of different food, and the shellfish and different regional tapas. And I just loved it. And then we opened this restaurant, really not knowing what we're doing. So let's open a tapas bar. And we went to various tapas bars in Ireland, in England, and also we went over to the States to see what tapas bars look like outside Spain. And then we opened this restaurant with this short tapas menu that was like a homage to Spain.
Yeah.
And then that got wrapped up with all of the different things that were happening, like the local food movement. So then we started to bring in more local food because we had farmers calling to us saying, would you use my chicken? And I go, yeah, I'd love to use your chicken. And so all of that narrative got wrapped up in our love of Spanish food.
Hmm.
And people really loved it as well, because it was such a new way, this is 10 years ago, of eating in Ireland. And I remember still people having difficulty sharing food. I mean, it was amazing. Like, where's my plate? And you're going, well, you're sharing. And it's going like, well, where's my three tapas? And you go, no, we're just going to drop them down as they're cooked. And go, well, I'm going to want these three together. And you go, that's not how it works. And it did take a long time.
Yeah.
It took about 2 years.
Just like convincing them that the toothpick was their plate.
Saying you need to share food. And people get it now. I mean, I think women got it way before the men. The men were in like going, why am I getting such a small portion? And why do I have to order three different things? Can I just order one thing? And we still, one of the things I still hate is that we give people an individual plate. And it was one of the things I had to give up on, because people felt that it's their security blanket. Then they make the most horrible concoctions where they bring four different tapas onto the plate, mix them all up, and then eat them. Go, this is really nice. And you're going, you're ruining my fucking food.
Don't play with your food.
Yes.
That's amazing, right? That sense of like personal space and like the idea that you should have one single... This is
my food
that will do me for tonight.
Yeah. I remember people walking out because we didn't do that. We actually had an a la carte and a tapas menu.
Mm.
And at the beginning, it was about 70% a la carte and 30% tapas.
Yeah.
And as the years went on, it became like 50, then 60, then 70. And then when we moved Cav after 5 years, and we said, we're not going to put on any main courses other than paella. We said, we're not putting on the steak. That's all gone. And it took a while for people to get used to it. And then people got used to it. But
how many people did you have to forcibly eject from the restaurant before that happened?
A few. You know, I had a few arguments with people in my day in Cava. We had four walk out because we didn't do steak. They came in and they were like, but you can get a steak tapa. They're like, can you make it bigger? And I was like, no, it's the tapa. You can get three of them if you want. They're like, no, we want the steak. Yeah, so they left. And I remember this woman waving a fucking lamb chop in my face because it was listed as rack of lamb. So we had cut the two individual chops off the rack. And she was like, a rack is always four. But I was like, a rack is not always four. A fucking rack of lamb is eight or nine. It's got eight or nine ribs. And she was like, no. And she was swinging this fucking chop in my face. Honestly, she got me on a bad day and I fucking threw her out of the restaurant. And I refused to take her money. And I remember her husband going, stop fighting, stop fighting. Her mother was just looking down and she was swinging this fucking chop in my face. Going, look at this, look at this. And I was like, get out. Just get the fuck out of here. And I said, I don't want your money. Just get out. And it's great pleasure. It's a great pleasure to throw people out of restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, as any listener to this episode can hear, you're a very charming and kind person, but it is fun to listen to you turn on a customer.
Yeah, it's happened maybe four times in 10 years. And
those are the bedtime stories I want you to tell me.
I'm like the cornered rat, you know, when I just like, oh, fuck this. And I just leave the kitchen. And another woman as well who ate everything and then said, came down and looked for a discount. And I was like, I didn't like it. And I was like, which bit didn't you like? You ate everything. So then I had this argument with her, and then I said, you know what? Get the fuck out of the restaurant. And she said, I want to pay something. And I was like, you're paying fucking nothing. And get out and never come back. And it was liberating. Yeah. She was actually, I'm going to ring the local radio station and tell them about you. And I was like, fucking tell them about me. Go on.
I should say, I feel like you've just kind of revealed some Groupon for a great discount at your restaurants. Going to be a complete unreasonable ass, and JP will perhaps get to the point where he will not accept your money.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can handle the conflict. You went from the tapas spot to Anir.
To Anir, a restaurant beside Cava closed down.
Yeah, Cava was the name of the tapas spot.
Yeah, I don't know what possessed me. In my right mind, I still don't know. Like, it's like the desire to write. What gave me the desire to open up more restaurants? I don't know. We wanted to do this restaurant. My friend Enda, it was just back from Noma. Suppose we went about and said, well, let's investigate Irish food. Let's look at Irish food and see what we can learn from the Nordics. You know, and that was the kind of model that we had. And I suppose one of the things I love about food is that you can do different things with it. And I'm not a purist by any means. I love Mexican food. I love Spanish food. I love Italian food. I mean, I love French food. And I'd never say define myself by one particular style of cooking. I mean, I love using beautiful products, and then I just go with it, you know. And I'm not a fusion cook either. Like, you know, I'm not going to combine
four different tapas on one plate.
No, I like to try and keep a little bit of integrity. And so we opened Anir as a little project, you know.
Yeah.
As a project to investigate wild food, seaweed, learn from the Nordics, you know. And 14 months later, we won a Michelin star, and it was like a fucking avalanche hitting the place. It was it nearly destroyed the whole restaurant, you know. And it was great. I mean, it was an international award, but 6 months later, there wasn't one person left in the kitchen than there was when we won the award. You get all these loons like going, oh, I'm going to get a Michelin star. My dining room's 90 covers. And I go, no, you're not. Like, it doesn't matter. I don't think it matters how good your food is, even though they'll say it's always about the food. I don't think it's possible to do what is required in European Michelin dining. It's different in Japan. It's different in Singapore. You could say it's different in other places because the Japanese, like, have it. You can have an eight-seater restaurant that has one star, one dish. That's my dream, you know? but I do think that it's about the relationship between the amount of cooks and floor staff you have and the amount of diners. And I think you should be looking at 40 to 45 tops. If you look at any three-star restaurant in the world, other than say 11 Madison, they do 110 a night, but they've got like 35 chefs in the kitchen.
Jesus.
And that's probably the busiest Michelin star restaurant, a three-star Michelin, I've ever been in.
Yeah.
And that takes, they have 70 staff working all the time, and they have 110, they do 110 diners. But like, to keep that level of consistency is just, I can't imagine the pressure.
Tell me about the menu at Anir. What makes it Irish? You know, how are you trying to define some new movement, if you are, through the food you're serving?
I suppose it's, the menu is product-driven, so it's seasonal. It's
what's on now?
It's so at the moment we have, like, say, celeriac, which is a seasonal vegetable. We have it with some pickled wild garlic that we preserved from earlier on in the spring. We have beef tartare with smoked egg yolk and some Dillisk seaweed. So the recognizable products, but we try and embed Irish products in them, or products that I think are worthy recipients. And so the big things when we're thinking about the menu is always like, how do we bring like wild food and seaweed into the menu? You know, we have all these wonderful seaweeds, we have all this wonderful wild food. How do we get it into the menu and weave it in so it's not like in your face? You know, you can still go in and have oysters and mussels and beef tartare, and we have wild duck on at the moment. We have it with a smoked pear and elderberries. So an elderberry sauce, there's wild berries, the pear is their local pears that we pickle and smoke. So it's a balance between this wild food and seaweed, and on the other side, we have the different traditions of preservation. And I'm fascinated by them, like pickling, salting, curing, smoking, fermenting. Like, I think it's amazing to think about how people kept food pre-refrigeration.
Right.
And we have just lost that because we don't need to think about it anymore.
No, because there's a freezer and it's full of fish fingers.
I think that in the 19... Oh, shit, that's my fucking phone.
People are like, hey, you're supposed to run a conference right now.
Yeah, that's probably my fucking children ringing me going, Daddy, where are you? It's like, why did you leave us in this bar to go up and talk to a man in this room?
Listen, man, a lot of kids have been through that and it's ended very differently.
Yeah. But no, it's a balance between those two things. And I want a near to be approachable. But at the same time, I mean, a lot of people think, oh, God, it's a bit weird because you say you're doing Irish food and you don't have stew on the menu.
Right.
And you go, shellfish. Oh, right. I don't eat shellfish. And you're going, was that the door?
That is the door.
Hi. Sorry.
No problem. Come on in.
I'm interrupting you. I have stuff here to drop from Food on the Edge.
Oh, I've heard of those guys.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Sorry for interrupting.
No problem.
No. You got surprise. You got a surprise.
This should happen in all of my podcast episodes where the guest somehow has arranged a gift bag and packet to arrive in my hotel room. Thank you, JP. I don't know what's in that, but it's just a bunch of Big Macs.
Yeah, it's a bunch of Big Macs and some dodgy Budweiser. Some local beer. There's a new burger place opening down by an ear, Hansen Burger. They have a great sense of provenance, and they've taken part in the food festival that we've organized over a couple of years, and it's burgers but just a little bit of terroir sprinkled over there, you know, with just enough, say, farmhouse cheese or the bun, or there's whatever product you take, there is a way to embed your local food culture into it, you know. And take duck, for example. People say, no, well, like, I get my wild duck from France because it's better than Irish wild duck. And I would say, like, well, that's questionable. But also, if you don't start to buy the Irish duck, and say to him, well, this is the way we'd like the duck, and give him a spec, because he's just out in the field shooting the fuckers out of the sky, you know. And you say, well, can we make sure that, like, they're not, like, shot to shit when we get them? And when you start to buy them, and he gets into it, and you get into it, and you say, well, look, I'm going to give you more money, the better the duck is. And then things grow. The fish is the same thing. And our fishmonger has said that he's been to Japan and seen what they do, and then come back to the Irish fishmonger going, saying, why are you kicking the shit out of the fish?
Yeah.
And they go, sure, it's fish. Right. You know, just fuck it all in a box. Doesn't matter what fucking type it is, you know, fuck the squid and on top of the turbot and on top of the mackerel. And you're going, well, how about, like, they're treat them nicely and I'll give you more money.
All right. Speed round. Then we'll finish.
I gotta go get the kids.
Yeah.
They're still there.
I'm looking out at something. I'll put a picture of this in the show page, but this is a picture of Loch Atalia.
Yeah, Loch Atalia. Yeah. It's a little, I suppose, small loch off Galway Bay.
It's like an estuary situation going on there. All right. So, and there's some herbage back there. There's a lot of waterfowl. There's something living in the muck. Give me a course that you'd make from Loch Atalia.
Loch Atalia. Jeez. Eat a swan, you know?
I like that.
Yeah, you're not allowed to eat swans. I think no, but...
Do you think it would taste?
I had a Dutch guy in the restaurant that asked me, why don't you eat the swans? Why don't you Irish eat the swans? And I was like, I actually don't know. So I had to go and look it up on Google. And seemingly...
Unnerving.
Because one guy was camping not too far from Loch Atalia, and they found... he had barbecued a swan. and it wasn't illegal, but at the same time, people had frowned upon it, saying, oh, the poor swan. But, like, no one gives a fuck about the turkeys, you know?
Yeah.
And
land swans.
The reason why we don't eat swans is because they don't reproduce fast enough. And that's the primary reason. But they used to eat them in Holland, and he was like, that's why he was asking me. And also, they're too big to fit in an oven.
Jesus,
I know.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, but you could,
and like, they're pretty aggressive too. You'd have to become ready to fight.
One of the interesting recipes that I came across were when I'm writing this Irish food cookbook was pickled herring. So I thought it was herring. I said they had just misspelled it, and I showed it to a food historian, and she was like, "No, it's herring, like the bird."
Pickled heron.
And the recipe, this is from 1780, from an Irish kind of big house, which were like country houses. So predominantly Protestant cooking. It said, take 100 herons and chop their heads off. Eviscerate the herons And then it went on to put spices like mace and nutmeg and cinnamon, and then to pickle them. And it was, do you know what it reminded me of? Like, almost like an escabeche. Like
right.
Which is like, they still do that in Spain with guinea fowl.
But that's a like slaughter on like an Audubon level.
That
like,
is, we have one heron in Galway Bay. And
you better get him and pickle him before.
And puffin as well. We're not allowed to eat puffin anymore in Ireland. But
well, that, yeah, I can imagine. I
know Iceland, they still eat them.
Yeah, the Faroes.
Like, but they're, they're like water pigeons, you know. They're like, because people go, oh, they're so cute looking. Yeah. And again, no one gives a fuck about the pigeons.
No, we can't anthropomorphize that. All right, but so we have a main dish of a swan.
A swan. I think we'd find some seaweed. We could
find some seaweed.
We could wrap them in seaweed.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, wrap them in kelp. Okay. And then barbecue them. You know?
Nice. Yeah.
And then I think you probably need a lot of butter, you know, because the swan is pretty lean.
Yeah.
So there's a dairy not too far away.
Yeah, I don't see a lot of butter right in this immediate vista, but
No. We could cook them. Do you know what I think we could do? We could brine them in the salt water.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, and then we could tenderize them and then wrap them in the kelp, cook them really slowly.
Yeah.
And then put them back into his feathers.
Like a beautiful
Like a
phoenix.
Swan pie. Like a swan pie. They used to eat swan pies in Holland. Do you know?
Bjork had a whole era that
really?
Was like that.
Oh yeah, that's true as well.
Swan pies.
And they used to, no wonder so many people got food poisoning. They used to like bake the swan and then wrap its flesh back over it. So when you came in, flay it.
Yeah.
And then bake it and then put it back in. Can you imagine the amount of bacteria that would be hanging around? And
everyone, just like on its scalp.
Everyone just going in for swan pie. And they're going, Jimmy died. Why did he die of? I don't know. We can't work it out.
I mean, that's where like chef and serial killer really kind of come together. You know,
100%.
let's take some cooked food and then wrap
and
it in.
And sometimes, I mean, maybe it is... like you can say, everyone has a tendency to violence inside them. I mean, we're human, and like killing animals, I think, is what also makes us human. And I do think we have a responsibility, but I think that if you eat meat or you eat fish, I think you have a responsibility to kill it.
Like and then to wrap it in its own flesh again.
Wrap it in kelp. Skin. Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. Among your other responsibilities, besides just killing,
killing swans.
Creatures.
Yeah. Hopefully you don't get any complaints
to be a father.
Yeah, if they ever get to listen to this show.
No, people love this. The killing swan stuff will be great. The Trip is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Produced by Josie Holtzman and Danielle Roth of Future Projects. Our editor is Roads and Kingdoms, Taffy Mukanyadze. Our executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Shouts, as always, to the legendary hip-hop producer Dan the Automator for the music, and to one of the great political illustrators of our time, Adele Rodriguez, for the art. Next week, I'll be in the same hotel room in Galway, destroying the Bloody Mary bar with the great Shannon Martinez, a meat-eating vegan chef from Melbourne, Australia. We'll meet you there.